We had multiple shots fired. That evolved to multiple victims and multiple shots at the school.
Another day in America.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, Radio Sputnik. Blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, an all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. And yes, we have another mass shooting to deal with. We'll get to that momentarily. But coming up in a bit, just 1 week ago, Democrats, many of them quite progressive, saw victories up and down the ballot in states across the country in 2017's so-called off-year elections. And while many were focused on the top of the ticket contests, like the Democratic gubernatorial victories in Virginia and New Jersey, there were a lot of noteworthy victories for Democrats, for everything from city councils to mayors to boards of education. And many of those victories were by first-time candidates for office. We will speak momentarily with the co-founder of one of the progressive groups who have specifically been working on encouraging and helping such first-time, often minority and female candidates and young candidates to run for office. We'll talk about their big wins last week and how the program works going forward into the 2018 midterm elections that will be held in all 50 states next year. So if you've ever even entertained the idea of running for office, you might want to stay tuned for that. Also, speaking of entertaining, Desi Doyen will be with us for our latest Green News Report.
Yes, well, I hope it's entertaining. I hope at the very least, it's informative.
We'll see. That's coming up straight ahead. And first, a very, very quick update for the moment on the story we've been covering quite a bit over the past few days, this Roy Moore disaster that is still unfolding for Senate Republicans. Two more Republican senators on Monday joined the flood, really, of lawmakers who are now calling for Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore to drop out of his race amid allegations that he sexually pursued and assaulted teenage girls, one at least as young as 14, while he was a district prosecutor in his 30s. Indiana Republican Senator Todd Young on Monday said the Senate must act to protect the integrity of the chamber. Did you know that they had integrity in that chamber, Desi Doyen? That they must do if Moore does not drop out. He tweeted, Roy Moore should immediately drop out of the race if he does not step aside. We need to act to protect the integrity of the Senate. He said the allegations that five now have made against Moore are, quote, far more persuasive than Moore's denial that he ever engaged in such behavior. Senator Tom Tillis, Republican of North Carolina, also called on Moore to immediately withdraw from the race. Tillis and Young's comments came after Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called on Monday for Moore to step aside. McConnell says Republicans are now actively seeking a write-in candidate to run against Moore, even as the December 12 election is already underway. Absentee ballots have been mailed out and are already being sent in. Senators Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah, Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, have also now joined the choir calling for Moore to withdraw from the race. After McConnell's remarks, I guess, gave permission to a whole bunch of them on Monday, National Republican Senatorial Committee Chair Cory Gardner of Colorado, as we noted on yesterday's program, has called on the Senate to expel Moore if, in fact, He refuses to withdraw the race and ends up winning that U.S. Senate seat from Alabama anyway. All of that was happening at the same time that a fifth woman came forward with allegations of violent misconduct by Moore when she was 16 years old at the time. Beverly Young Nelson told reporters on Monday that Moore had sexually assaulted her when she was a teenager and left bruises on her neck at the time when she resisted. Moore, for his part, has denied all of the allegations against him. So we'll continue to follow that story, no doubt, in the days ahead. There was it was a very busy day in D.C. today. There were hearings on Capitol Hill in the U.S. House on sexual harassment in Congress. Yes, in Congress itself, including testimony that some still serving members inappropriately harass their colleagues in the U.S. House and Senate, though no names yet, to my knowledge.
Yes, I think they're still trying to maintain some level of collegiality. I'm not exactly sure why.
Yeah, I don't know why. If they're sexually harassing people, hopefully they've reported that to the Ethics Committee. There are also hearings in the U.S. House Judiciary Committee with Attorney General Jeff Sessions testifying on a huge range of issues. Focusing quite a bit, at least for Democrats, on Sessions's selective memory, as those Democrats have described, his response to the Trump campaign meetings with various Russian officials and agents that he forgot about until he was reminded about later. Also on comments on the Alabama Republican U.S. Senate candidate, Roy Moore, because remember, this is Jeff Sessions. This was the seat that he gave up when he became Trump's attorney general. And Sessions, during this hearing today, said he had, quote, no reason to doubt the women who are accusing Moore of those incidents of sexual assault when they were minors. He was also asked about his openness. That was initially reported on Monday. His openness to a special counsel investigation of Hillary Clinton, of course, and the right wing's pretend so-called Uranium One scandal. Sessions was also asked about a recent DOJ assessment of so-called black identity extremists, while conceding that he could not recall any such similar assessments made of white identity extremists, such as neo-Nazis and the KKK. There are also hearings over in the U.S. Senate, in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, on the power of the president to launch war and specifically to launch a nuclear attack without the ability for anybody to stop him or her from doing so. That was chaired by Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee, and it was the first such congressional examination of that issue since 1976. So we are likely to cover some of those noteworthy hearings in the days ahead, but since we probably won't get to covering this, or at least the media won't be able to give this much coverage, I suspect, because, you know, mass shootings in the U.S., even when they involve school children, apparently they're now a dime a dozen. They tend to disappear from the national media radar very quickly if and when they are covered at all. Well, on Tuesday, out here in California, up in Northern California, gunmen choosing targets at random opened fire in a rural Northern California town on Tuesday, killing five people at several different sites, wounding others at an elementary school before police shot him dead. At least another 10 people have been hospitalized, two of them children. Though counter to earlier reports, neither of those children have been killed. The gunfire began around 8 a.m. in a community of Rancho Tehama Reserve. That's about 130 miles north of Sacramento. Here is Tehama County Assistant Sheriff Phil Johnston in his initial report to a local NBC affiliate, KCRA, shortly after the shootings were first reported.
I don't know what time the call came in. It was right about 8 a.m. We had multiple shots fired in Rancho Tehama. That evolved to multiple victims and multiple shots at the school, the elementary school. I am told at this point the suspected shooter is deceased by law enforcement bullets. That's what I'm told. I know that we have medevaced a number of students. I know that the school has been cleared. I know that we have the children that were attending school in a safe location at this time. We have about 100 law enforcement personnel in Rancho Tehama right now with multiple scenes. I can think of at least 5 scenes that I've been told about. So we are spread thin, but we have a lot of resources right now, and you can see that we're still requesting ambulances and we're still doing our work. That's the only information I have.
That was Tehama County Assistant Sheriff Phil Johnston. I suspect that we could do a show like this, as he's doing every goddamn day at this point in this country.
Yes, I'm sorry to say that I think you're right.
Police offered no immediate word on the motive by the assailant. Sheriff's official said that the shooter's neighbors, however, had reported a domestic violence incident. This seems to be a common thread in so many of these shootings.
And there's a reason why.
Yeah.
Because it is.
Yeah. Well, yeah, apparently. Witnesses reported hearing gunshots and hearing children screaming at an elementary school where the the school was about 5 miles down the road, apparently, from where the shooting is believed to have started. Details are still sketchy right now, even though we're hours after the shooting. Authorities did not have a firm count of the wounded due to the number of places that the gunman attacked, said Johnston. So there was, I think, about 7 different scenes. Brian Flint told the Record Searchlight he was a neighbor of the shooter, apparently, in the city of Redding. He knows the shooter only as Kevin. He says he was the gunman and that his roommate was among the victims. He said the crazy thing is that the neighbor has been shooting a lot of bullets lately, hundreds of rounds, large magazines. Flint said he was that they made it aware that this guy is crazy and he's being threatening to us, but apparently nothing was done. Now, the KCRA, the local NBC affiliate, reports that no children were killed in the shooting so far. However, one student was shot at the school itself, and a second child and a woman were also shot inside a truck as they drove past the gunman, who was apparently just firing randomly out the window. The child inside the truck suffered non-life-threatening wounds, and the woman had serious life-threatening injuries, unfortunately. According to Johnston, there's no word on the condition of the boy shot inside the school at this hour. The gunman, his name was not yet released, but he stole a white pickup truck, and he initially began firing and went on this shooting rampage throughout the community, according to officials, just picking targets as he fired shots at 7 different shooting scenes in the area. The shooter targeted the school from outside the school, shot inside the school with multiple rounds, Johnston said. That from a second stolen vehicle. Officers found a semi-automatic rifle and 2 handguns with the gunman after he was taken down. The shooter's name and age has not yet been released. The man they have tentatively identified has had prior contacts, however, with law enforcement officers. Deputies went to his home on Monday, after a report of a domestic violence incident. But apparently he was allowed to just keep his guns. The preliminary investigation revealed that he had purchased those guns legally. It is still unclear, according to the Record Searchlight, what that motive was for that shooter. But officials said that there was a history of neighborhood issues with the gunman. And at this school in particular where he had targeted, apparently it's not the first time this school has had a gun scare. In December of 2015, a then 43-year-old woman was arrested after a school employee called law enforcement because she was allegedly walking around with a sawed-off shotgun.
Wow.
We've got some issues in this country. Rancho Tehama Reserve is a subdivision home to about 1,400 people. It's described on its website as a quiet, private country community. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the area is 86% white as of 2010, has a poverty rate of 43%.
That's a very high poverty rate.
Brian Flint, and it's also represented by a whole bunch of Republicans. Brian Flint, that neighbor who lived next to the alleged gunman, said living next to him was, quote, hell. Flint was a known felon who often harassed him and his neighbors. And yet somehow this felon was able to legally purchase a semi-automatic weapon and rifle and two handguns. Politicians began weighing in on the shooting. Of course, Vice President Mike Pence said, quote, we pray for comfort and healing for all impacted. California Republican State Senator Jim Nielsen, who oversees the area of the shooting, said that his heart goes out to the victims and that we will be praying for the speedy recovery of those injured. He said, we lift up in prayer those killed and wounded, their families and their loved ones. U.S. Congressman Doug LaMalfa, also a Republican whose district includes Rancho Tehama, wrote on Facebook that people should pray for the ugly situation there. California Assemblyman Brian Dahl, a Republican, wrote on Twitter that his prayers are with the innocent victims. That was the Republican response, a lot of praying. Meanwhile, the Democratic candidates for governor out here in California, including California Treasurer John Chang, said on Twitter, there is nothing more horrifying than people, especially children, dying from a gun shooting because this can and should be prevented, he said. While we grieve today for the innocent victims, tomorrow we will honor them by working even harder at making California a safer place for all. Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, who is also running next year for governor, said on Twitter that the shooting epidemic has stolen too many lives in the U.S. He said we need immediate action to put an end to this nightmare. Notice anything different between those Democratic and Republican responses? Want better politicians who won't just pray away our gun epidemic in this country? Want elected officials who may actually do something other than pray about this national epidemic? My guest coming up says it's time that you, yes, you, you, consider running for office rather than waiting for someone else to take action. A quick break, and we are back with that story and much more on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. Hey, it's Brad, and you're listening to the Bradcast on Radio Sputnik.
Headed for the open door. Tell me what you're waiting for. Look across the great divide. Soon they're gonna hear the sound, sound, sound. We come running.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe they'll come running. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. My guest coming up momentarily may help them come running. Well, it is one thing to vote and then root for your favorite candidates for office to win. It's another thing to be one of those candidates. Our nation, at least in theory, is run by a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. At least that used to be the idea. And that means that people, not just industry experts, lobbyists, wealthy Americans, a professional political class, need to step up to run for the tens of thousands of elected offices across the country in federal, state, and local elections every 2 to 4 years. If we, the people, don't step up, the so-called professional political class will, and they will continue to control the levers of government. For everything from the White House to Congress down to dog catcher. Well, maybe not dog catcher, but state and local government, county clerks, boards of education, city councils, and other key elected positions that make a lot of important decisions. Republicans seem to have figured that out some time ago, and they've had right-leaning organizations supporting and grooming candidates for all sorts of state and local offices for some time. And they've been winning those elections for some time. After the Democrats' disastrous 2016 elections, coming after at least a decade of Republican gains at the state and local levels of government, a number of progressive groups seem to have finally figured out that all politics is local, or at least that it usually begins that way, as candidates get experience in local and state government before they decide to run for, say, statewide office or the White House, our current president notwithstanding. But following the losses in 2016, last week, Democrats saw big victories last week across the country during off-year elections held in about one-third of the states. Democrats won big-ticket offices that were on the ballot last week, like governor of Virginia and New Jersey and mayor of New York City, but also many first-time progressive candidates, many of them young and female and minorities, also stepped up and saw victories everywhere from Virginia's House of Delegates, which, as almost nobody predicted, could actually flip to a Democratic majority after last week's election and a number of upcoming challenges and recounts in several races there, to the City Council of Minneapolis, to mayoral victories in Topeka, Kansas, and Hoboken, New Jersey, Charlotte, North Carolina, and many other municipalities around the country. Many of those candidates who won for the first time were helped by several different new progressive organizations, which stepped up to help those progressive candidates run for office, including Bernie Sanders' Our Revolution group and another called Run for Something, formed by former Hillary Clinton campaign staffer Amanda Littman and longtime Democratic campaign consultant Ross Morales Rocchetto. As Politico noted when reporting in October, that Run for Something had organized and endorsed more than 120 young progressive candidates to run for office in the 2017 and 2018 cycles so far, many of those candidates were and are running for seats such as county clerk and library committee. They noted the group is touting their endorsements as millennial candidates who are rebuilding the Democratic Party from the ground up. That sounds like a good idea. Co-founder Littman noted that their candidates are not complacent with the status quo and they're not waiting for someone to tap them on the shoulder to run. Instead, they're changing lives to get in the fight, and in the process, they're changing their communities for the better. If last week's results are any evidence, the strategy appears to be off to a gangbuster start. Many of the Our Revolution candidates were victorious last week, as were Run for Somethings, which, along with a whole bunch of other progressive organizations, have declared today to be National Run for Office Day, with a website at runforofficeday.com that declares at the top in all caps, you, yes, you should run for office or ask a friend to. So should you, yes, you run for office? And will there be any help out there for you if you do? Here to discuss all of this today is Run for Something's co-founder, Ross Morales Rocchetto. He is a progressive political operative with 15 years of experience in campaign management, grassroots organizing, and data analytics. Ross Morales Rocchetto, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Hello. How's it going? And thanks for having me.
You bet. Thank you for joining us. First, I think some congratulations are certainly in order here. You have pinned at the top of your Twitter feed that 10% of first-time candidates win, but yet Run for Something had more than 40% of your candidates who won last Tuesday?
That's correct. So we had about 72 candidates running in the Tuesday election. Mm-hmm. 32 of those candidates won. Another four are actually in elections that are too close to call, either in recounts mm-hmm. or currently exploring options.
You said 32 candidates so far were victorious of yours last week?
Yep, correct.
Wow. How much do you attribute that then to the general anti-Trump sentiment in the country right now, because there's a lot of that, versus your specific recruitment efforts and financial help and the training that you offer to your candidates, Ross?
You know, I would actually say it's probably a little bit of both, to be completely honest. I think, you know, one thing that we learned from the election, I think, on Tuesday, not just in Virginia, but also in New Jersey, and in the 12 additional states that had elections, is that the sort of cloud of Donald Trump is a little bit more elastic than I think what a lot of people had originally anticipated. So, I, you know, there were a lot of people before the Virginia election that were making assumptions that, you know, that sort of enthusiasm that's been generated, mm-hmm. You know, in response or sort of like anti-Trump sentiment has, like, would drive additional turnout. I think people were a little skeptical that that would hold a full, almost a full year after he was elected. I think some of it was that. I would say the other part of it, though, honestly, is that we had on our side really amazing people that were running. You know, we had Annika Rome, the transgender woman who was running against Bob Marshall, the guy who sponsored the bathroom bill.
Yep.
We had a woman named Jennifer Carol Foy running as well, who gave birth to twins in the middle of her campaign.
Right.
We had some really excellent people that were running, and I think, you know, when you have good candidates that are running campaigns that are designed to have one-on-one conversations with voters, I think that's how you end up getting wins.
Now, did you find these candidates, or did they find you?
That's also a combination of both. Mm-hmm. So, you know, about half the candidates we worked with sort of from the very beginning. Another half, we, you know, came to us and we were interested in working with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, part of what we do is we want to work with folks as early in the process as possible. And your resources just go so much further when you work with them early in a campaign, early in an election cycle. That way, by the time they get to election day, they've already done a lot of the really, almost all of the really hard work that needs to be done.
How did you and Amanda Littman, your co-founder at Run for Something, how did you guys decide to form it in the first place? I think Amanda actually has a book out called Don't Just March, Run for Something, and it seems to have been formed from the tears of the 2016 presidential campaign. Tell me about the way you guys decided to form Run for Something, and how would you generally describe its mission?
Yeah, I would say it was, it was definitely, I think born out of the tears of the 2016 election is the right way to describe it. Amanda worked on the Clinton campaign. My wife also worked on the Clinton campaign. We knew each other socially. Amanda had expressed interest to a number of her friends that she was interested in doing this. And my wife, who knows that I had tried to, I've done similar types of candidate recruitment efforts in the past,
mm-hmm.
connected us. We talked and we, you know, decided that this is something we wanted to do together. And, you know, as far as our mission goes, what we're really trying to do is recruit and support the next generation of progressive Democrats running down ticket. And so, you know, we work with local candidates. We think that, you know, 2018, for example, is going to be the year of the down ballot candidate.
Mm-hmm.
We work with folks that are younger. We know that only 5% of state legislators across the country are millennial.
Mm.
And the millennial generation is, you know, going to be the largest voting bloc in the next set of presidential elections.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's what we're setting out to do, you know, specifically in 2018. We have plans to endorse over 1,000 candidates around the country and work, you know, and recruit at least 50,000 people who told us that they're interested in running for office.
You say 50,000 people?
50. Yep.
50,000 people have told you they're interested. I noticed that at your website that you're looking mostly for young people, 35 and under, specifically women and people of color. So I guess that pretty much rules me right out, Ross. But that said, on all those points, but what is your criteria for choosing candidates to support? If you've got 50,000 people who have reached out, how do you decide who to support and not?
And that 50,000 number is a goal for 2018. Right now we have a little over 12,000 people
mm-hmm.
Who've signed up and expressed interest in running for office. We have a few really basic criteria. One is that, you know, you're 35-ish.
Mm-hmm.
We've worked with a number of candidates that are a little bit older than 35.
That's okay, Ross. You don't have to make me feel any better. That's all right. I understand. Go ahead.
Two is that you're deeply rooted in your community and are representative of the community that you're trying to serve. And, you know, the other piece is we really want people who are compelling individuals or have compelling stories. And, you know, we want people who have progressive values.
And I want to ask you about those values and how they how that plays into your decision. But I want to give you a quick chance here to explain why is it important to run for local office, for boards of education, for library committees and so forth. And if someone decided to do that, how would you help someone? Let's say I was under 35 and a person of color. What would I do and how would you potentially help me? To, I guess, decide to run for that office, and how what kind of help would you offer if I did?
You know, we've been hearing from people all across the country that in this particular moment, they want to make a difference in their communities. And honestly, one of the best ways and the most effective ways to make a difference in your community is to run for office locally. If you aren't happy with your schools, you can run for your school board. If you're not happy with the fact that, like, the road outside your house has potholes or doesn't get plowed when it snows, you can run for city council. You know, if you are unhappy with, in a lot of places, if you're unhappy, you know, with the cost of, you know, your water or the community colleges or, you know, a number of other things in your community, like, you can run for boards that are elected that have people making those types of decisions. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the things that impact people's lives the most on a day-to-day basis tend to be at that local level. And, you know, that's, you know, what's been so powerful about, you know, the stories that we hear from our candidates that are running, because we have a young woman up in Southeast Pennsylvania named Heather Ward. Mm-hmm. She, you know, is 22 years old. She was just finishing up school, and she decided to run for school board because, you know, she saw what Betsy DeVos was doing, and she wanted to make a difference. You know, she ran in a district that is largely Republican. Mm-hmm. And essentially by going door to door and talking, having one-on-one conversations with voters, she won people over, and she actually just won, she just became a member of the school board, on Tuesday, at 22 years old, the youngest member of that school board. And you know, we hear stories like that from around the country, and you know, in a lot of communities, a lot of the issues that are there, like, aren't necessarily Democrat or Republican. There are issues that people need. There are problems that people need solved in their daily lives. And what they really need is people to come in there who are passionate and solve them.
How important is, and one of the criticisms of Democrats, the Democratic Party for years, is that they would only recruit candidates generally who already had a lot of money. And I suspect a lot of people consider running for office and they say, well, I don't have a lot of money. I can't put a lot of my own money into the race. How important is money to a candidate in making a decision to run for something like boards of education and library committee and city council and so forth? And does run for something help them in that regard if they need help financially in that sense?
This is one of my favorite things to talk about. So money, unfortunately, makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of these local races, it's not quite as important as it is you know, like in congressional or even like some large state legislative elections. Mm-hmm. But it still matters, and you need to have it in order to run a campaign that's going to win. And I like playing a little on your point, like the idea that, you know, we've sort of tied viability as a party to your ability to raise money.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what that means is, you know, only we're going to continue getting the same type of people elected to office every single time. And, you know, if you're a woman, if you're a person of color, you know, if you come from a rural low-income community, we do work with white candidates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's important those individuals, you know, don't have the same kind of network, you know, that a lot of other folks do. And when you're raising money for these races, mm-hmm. you're raising money from basically your friends and family and the people that is sort of you've cultivated in your community around you over the years. And if those people, you know, like don't have, you know, $2,700 to spare or whatever it is to give a maximum contribution, mm-hmm. You know, you're at a pretty significant disadvantage. So, you know, in Virginia, we gave money directly to a number of our candidates, you know, that we had endorsed. We endorsed 10 folks. We spent about a total of $200,000 in that particular election. And, you know, it's important. Raising money is extremely important. And the last thing I'll say is that, you know, if you're running for a small town school board race, you don't need $100,000. You might only need $5,000 or $10,000. And what that's really paying for, that's for you to get a list of voters so mm-hmm. that you can know who you need to be talking to. And basically you need to print literature so that you can go out and knock on doors and leave something behind for folks.
And even coming up with $5,000 or $10,000 will obviously be an obstacle for many people. If does your website offer tips and help on how to raise that initial money to get going?
We do. We have mentors that are ready to work directly with our candidates mm-hmm. on a whole host of issues, ranging from just that, like how do I put together a fundraising plan. Mm-hmm. To, you know, how do I put together a strategy to talk to as many voters as possible in the right order? So we offer a number of services, coaching, mentorship. We help get people connected. We help get candidates connected to each other, mm-hmm. Which is, I think, one of the more important things that we do, because running for office is really lonely. Nobody wants to hear you complaining. That's around you. Your campaign manager doesn't. Your family doesn't want to hear it because you know, when you run, you put them through a lot. And so really the only other people who understand it are people who are running or have run before. And we also get people connected to resources throughout the progressive and democratic communities. You know, we get them connected to trainings that are happening. We get them connected to, you know, organizations that have volunteer resources, to try to turn out volunteers for our candidates. We get them connected to individuals who might be willing to make a contribution to their campaign. So we do a whole host of things for candidates, and one of them is making sure that we're at least providing them a structure so that they can understand how fundraising for these things works and how they can do it in the most efficient way possible.
How would you say, Ross, that Run for Something is different from, for example, Bernie Sanders' Our Revolution group, whose endorsed candidates also performed very well on Tuesday, as I understand? Is there an overlap between the two groups and some of these other groups? And then, I'll ask you about the political aspect here. But just organizationally, structurally, how are the those groups different from each other?
Totally. Our Revolution, I think, also had a really good night on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. Lee Carter is the person that just sort of comes to the top of my mind, who is running in Virginia. I believe he identifies as a Democratic Socialist. Mm-hmm. And he beat, I believe, the House Majority Whip,
right.
Which is huge.
Yeah, the third ranking Republican, a longtime entrenched guy who had been in the Virginia House of Delegates for years, and he beat him after, by the way, reportedly, Democrats told him, oh, if you run too far to the left, you will lose. So that's why I'm trying to get a sense of the politics here, as well as the organizational structure between the various groups.
Totally. I would say that we're complementary of each other. So we work with the folks over at Our Revolution. Actually, today is National Run for Office Day, as you said in your opening. They're one of our partners for National Run for Office Day. Their chairwoman, Senator Nina Turner, made a video talking about how important it was to run for office. Mm-hmm. You know, we're also working with groups like Secretary Clinton's group Onward Together. And, you know, I would say one of the things that is really important for us is that we are doing everything that we can to get all of the help for our candidates that it exists out there. And we're not interested ourselves in reinventing the wheel. If we think, you know, there is a number of organizations that are really excellent at doing training, so we will send our candidates to those trainings. What we're really interested in doing is just making sure that the people that we recruit know and understand how important running for office is, and that they're running good, solid, grassroots-oriented campaigns.
Is there a litmus test then when you're choosing which candidates you're going to support as far as progressivism goes? You know, if they're too progressive, not progressive enough, are Bernie fans as welcome at Run for Something as Hillary supporters would be, for example?
Totally. I would say probably close to half of the candidates that we work with are, or at worst, supporters of Senator Sanders in the primary. Mm-hmm. You know, for us, you know, in order for us to win, like, we need to run people who are truly representative of their communities. So in some communities, you know, that means that you would want a certain type of candidate to be running, you know, then you might want, like, in the state of Alabama, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have a core set of progressive values that we ask our candidates to ascribe by. You know, we monitor, we hear back, you know, we mm-hmm. look at what they're saying in the press. We haven't had any, you know, issues so far in terms of, you know, people telling us one thing and then doing and saying another.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for us, it was really important to lay out a set of values rather than to talk about a specific set of policies.
Other than politically, last question here, I think, how would you say Run for Something is different from Republican groups that may be doing something similar, that have been doing something similar for years? And it's somewhat maddening, you know, when I see a lot of these candidates, a lot of these races, Republican and Democratic alike, where the candidates run completely uncontested. So would you say that Run for Something, the work that you guys do, is different from the Republican groups that may do something similar, or is it in some way based on what GOP groups, not politically, but the way, you know, they recruit their own people, the way GOP groups have been so effective at doing, it seems, for so many years now?
You know, one of the things that I like to talk about is how, you know, we all know that there's a distinction in styles between, you know, how folks on the left and how folks on the right tend to operate. And, you know, on the right, you know, they'll give tons of money to one or two central groups, and then, like, those groups will, you know, like, decide and go out and do things in, like, an extremely methodical way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're Democrats. And so we've taken, like, a much more grassroots approach and strategy to candidate recruitment. And to be honest, like, for us, what we're really interested in is getting as many people interested and to sign up to run as we can. We, you know, I think in an ideal world, we would be running, you know, somebody with a D next to their name in every single state legislative district across the country, regardless of whether that candidate, you know, is likely to win or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to get back to doing things like that, because it isn't just a feel good story. It has real implications. You know, you saw in the Virginia election, you know, this reverse coattails effect where, you know, a number of the down ballot candidates, our delegate candidates, help pull up and get extra votes for the top of the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the way that we win back Congress and the way that we take back state legislatures is by focusing on folks at the local level, because those are people who are authentic messengers to their community. They're going out every day and having one-on-one conversations at the doors. You know, it's almost like having, like, small organizing pods, you know, like in every single district across the country, with, you know, like, candidates going out, you know, and talking to voters in a way that, you know, a congressional candidate or somebody running statewide might not be able to do themselves, or might not even have the resources to do. You know, and if we can focus on that, if we can focus on those types of things and not get caught up with, like, producing the shiniest television ad. I think we have a real shot in 2018. That isn't to say that, you know, television and direct mail and more traditional campaign methods don't have a role to play. I actually believe that they do. But it is to say that we really need to be focusing on the local level, and we really need to be thinking about the implications that running somebody in all of these districts will have up and down the ticket.
Yeah, and I think that since you had mentioned Lee Carter, he was a 30-year-old Marine veteran, and he easily won. He actually got 55% of the vote in his Virginia race in a very Republican area against that third-ranking Republican in the House of Delegates. So even, Ross, when you talk about the different way, perhaps, that candidates might run in Alabama versus California, the idea that the people go unchallenged and that people pull back their progressivism out of fear, I think has, at least last Tuesday, that thinking has sort of taken a bit of a beating. It seems that when people do step up and are authentic, they have a very good chance of winning. I'm going to point people towards your website. It's a really fun website, by the way, Ross, at runforsomething.net. Just to think about it, to think about running, and if you're not going to run, at least think about supporting the work that runforsomething.net does. I think it's really important work. It is a fun website. You almost had me there until I got to realizing that I was so old and white and male. But other than that, there's some good stuff there for everyone who might be considering running for office. Ross Morales Rocchetto, website is runforsomething.net, and on the Twitters, follow them at runforsomething, and follow Ross on the Twitters at RossMoRock. Did I hit everything, Ross?
You got it. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you, and good luck. Please stay in touch as you head into 2018.
We certainly will. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Okay, quick break, and we're back with Desi Doyen and the Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad, and you're listening to the Bradcast on Radio Sputnik. Welcome back to the Bradcast. That song means it's Desi Doyen's Green News Report coming up momentarily. You know, I had a number of stories I wanted to cover on the actually the problem with white male politicians that I had to put off. I was joking, of course, with Ross there about that. I had to put those stories off because of the shooting in Northern California. Maybe we'll get to them a little bit later in the week. But yeah, it would be nice to see younger people, women, minorities run like hell for office.
Yes, it would.
All over the country.
Yeah, actually, I remember being in high school in Texas, and I remember one of my teachers saying, wow, there sure are a lot of Christian right-wingers running for school board all of a sudden. Mm. And that was, I think, the beginning of that push.
That was when they figured it out, right?
Yeah.
We'll see if Democrats figured it out. I'd love to see that happen, if only because it'll make Trump supporters crazy. It'll drive them crazy, although that's not a very long drive. All right. Anyway, let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
The world is moving on, and so is the United States.
At UN climate talks in Bonn, Germany, the U.S. is a bit schizophrenic. New report shows Paris Agreement targets are not nearly enough. Senate approves fossil fuel lobbyist for top EPA air pollution position. Plus, Puerto Rico's governor estimates damages after Hurricane Maria are $95 billion.
All of those damages and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
So what will make strong hurricanes more and more frequent? According to our government, the answer is none of your f***ing business. Stop asking so many questions.
Agreed. If you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, well, after a main power line went out in Puerto Rico late last week, dropping the island from 40% power capacity back down to 18%. That has now been fixed. And now, 7 weeks after Hurricane Maria made landfall, still 50% of the island is without power.
Yes, the recovery is going extremely slowly. And Puerto Rican Governor Ricardo Rossello on Monday estimated that rebuilding the island after two back-to-back hurricanes, both Irma and Maria, will cost $95 billion. That's an amount roughly equal to the island's entire annual gross domestic product. Rossello asked Congress to cover the costs of the reconstruction price tag as, quote, an important step to demonstrate that the federal government will treat Puerto Ricans like any other American citizens.
Oh, sure. The federal government giving $95 billion to Puerto Rico. Good luck with that, Puerto Rico.
Meanwhile, in Texas, which is now rebuilding from Hurricane Harvey, a new MIT study calculates that climate change made Hurricane Harvey about six times more likely, and that the state's annual risk of similar extreme rainfall events in any given year is now 18% higher thanks to global warming.
Thanks, global warming.
Meanwhile, in the U.S. Senate, the majority Republicans voted strictly along party lines to confirm fossil fuel industry lawyer and lobbyist William Wareham for the number two spot at the EPA. Wareham has spent his...
Let me just break in there. That's the fossil fuel lobbyist who now is the number two guy at the Environmental Protection Agency.
That's right.
Got it.
Wareham has spent his career suing the EPA to roll back clean air standards that restrict mercury, silica, lead, and smog.
And we call that regulatory capture, do we not?
Yes, we do.
Well done, fossil fuel industry.
At the United Nations climate talks now underway in Bonn, Germany, international negotiators are hammering out the mechanisms for 195 nations to reduce their emissions under the landmark Paris Climate Agreement. But a new report from the United Nations Environment Program calculates that the current national commitments under that agreement are only about one-third of the reductions needed to avoid shooting past the agreed-upon target of no more than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures. However, the report also concludes that accelerating the transition to solar and wind energy, replanting forests, and increasing the energy efficiency of our cars and buildings can help close that gap.
That sounds like a great idea. I suspect everyone in the world except the U.S. will be interested.
Well, last week, the United States became the only nation on the planet not included in that agreement. That's thanks to President Trump's intention to withdraw from the Paris Agreement in 2020. But a Trump administration delegation is attending the Bonn climate talks anyway.
And I hope they are being met with boos and hisses.
Yeah, pretty much. On Monday, they hosted an event to promote so-called U.S. clean coal and nuclear energy technology to developing countries as a way to cut their emissions. And, of course, they were interrupted by a climate action youth protest.
So you claim to be an American, but we see right through your greed. It's killing all across the world for that coal mining, and we proudly stand up.
And a shadow delegation is also representing the U.S. in Bonn, a coalition of states, cities, and businesses seeking to highlight positive U.S. climate efforts and strike their own deals on the subnational level.
Are they better singers?
I hope so. But their schizophrenic parallel U.S. presence is creating some confusion for other countries, according to the New York Times, who aren't quite sure who to trust. Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who is leading the state action coalition, on Monday criticized the Trump administration and noted that, thanks to the states, the U.S. is already halfway to meeting the Obama administration's pledge to cut U.S. emissions.
It is important for the world to know the American government may have pulled out of the Paris Agreement, but the American people are committed to its goals, and there is nothing Washington can do to stop us.
Well, that's good to hear, but Washington is going to keep trying to roll the clock backwards. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide, please, on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Well, that's optimistic.
Yeah, well, you know, better to be optimistic than pessimistic. It gets a lot more done.
Says you.
Says me.
All right. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen, our producer. And to my guest today, Ross Morales Ricchetto of runforsomething.net. My thanks, as ever, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is always greatly appreciated. You can drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am simply The Brad Blog. And if you missed any portion of today's program or any other, you can download any of them anytime for free at bradblog.com. Though my huge thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help us continue to do what we try to do every day over your public airwaves. That's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.